to me. Oh, oh,
I despise. And good evening. You're listening to part two of the Pacifica Radio Network's crisis coverage of an assault on the peace, the invasion of Iraq. President Bush has warned the U.S. tonight to brace for war, but millions of Americans are instead choosing to fight for peace. As the drums of war beat louder and louder from the corridors of the White House and the president and his cabinet declare that time for diplomacy is over, Patriots for Peace have taken to the streets around the country demanding that their cries for a nonviolent solution to disarming Saddam Hussein be recognized by the Bush administration. Good evening. I'm Verna Avery Brown of Peace Watch. My guests in the studio tonight are Mara Verheiden Hilliard, a constitutional rights attorney and co-founder of Partnership for Civil Justice. She's also working with former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark on articles of impeachment for President Bush. Our second studio guest here in Washington is Chris Tensing of the Middle East Report, a publication of the Middle East Research Information Institute in Washington, D.C. And joining us from New York City for this special crisis coverage by Pacifica Radio is my co-host Amy Goodman of Democracy Now. Good evening, Amy.
It's good to be with you, Verna. And I'm here with Dennis Halliday, the former UN Assistant Secretary General, was at the United Nations for more than three decades, headed the Oil for Food program in Iraq, and now gets arrested, now travels around the world protesting the sanctions against Iraq, as well as right now the Bush push for war.
We're also going to open up the phone lines tonight and invite feedback from our listening audience across the country. So if you're listening to our program on one of our sister stations, WPFW in Washington, WBAI in New York, KPFK in Los Angeles, KPFA in Berkeley, or KPFT in Houston, we invite you to call in. The 800 number to dial if you want to weigh in on the conversation is 1-800-985-9008. That's actually 1-800-958-9008. You know, the president says after 12 years of failed diplomacy, Saddam Hussein must be disarmed. He says his regime has a record of reckless aggression in the Middle East and that we, or rather he, has the sovereign authority to ensure the security of the nation. Mara, I'd like to begin with you. You and others can jump in as we go along, but please remember to identify yourself before you speak. Mara, you're working to impeach President Bush. For what exactly?
We are working to impeach President Bush and John Ashcroft, Dick Cheney, and Rumsfeld for threatening and committing crimes against peace, crimes against humanity, for usurping the proper power of the judiciary, the legislative branch, as well as the rights reserved to the people of the United States. He is acting unilaterally, he is threatening and causing wars of aggression, and he has acted against the will of the people of the United States. He has constructed an imperial presidency and is not a government that can continue to exist.
So you can actually impeach him before any crime is committed?
He's committed these crimes already. He has violated the international laws of crimes against peace and crimes against humanity by threatening a war of aggression against Iraq, against a country that has not threatened and poses no threat to attack the United States. He has committed crimes against peace and crimes against humanity against the civilian populations of Afghanistan. And he has committed crimes against the people of the United States in terms of the deprivations of the civil rights of the people of the United States with mass detentions and sweeps and the use of torture. And these are things that cannot go unchallenged. Mm. And it appears now that there is just a mass outpouring of people from around the United States since articles of impeachment have been drafted and put up at votetoimpeach.org. And there are tens of thousands of people who are voting to impeach, who are sending in boxes of petitions. People recognize that it's time to remove him.
And I want to invite all of our guests to just sort of jump in if you at random or at will. I'm curious to know, however, if there's an opportunity to impeach the president, what about the fact that the Congress actually gave the president the authority to use force?
Well, there are many who believe that, in fact, Congress has not given the president the authority to use force. That is why some have gone to file litigation to seek to force the president to seek an additional resolution from Congress. But in our view, even if Congress were to authorize some type of use of force against Iraq, this is a war that violates the UN Charter. And the UN Charter is considered the supreme law of the land under the Constitution. And with or without congressional authorization, with or without UN authorization, waging this war of aggression, a bombing campaign, a slaughter of the people of Iraq against a country that is not threatened and is not attacking the United States, violates the UN Charter, and it is illegal by all means.
I think that's the relevant point here in this situation, that with Bush claiming in his speech tonight that this is about enforcing three previous UN resolutions, 678, 687, and 1441, it is not legal for nations to enforce UN Security Council resolutions and act in violation of the UN Charter. And the standard set by the UN Charter is quite clear, that one country can attack another only if it has previously been attacked or if it is under imminent threat of attack. That's a later interpretation added to the article. And clearly, neither one of those cases obtain here. So clearly, the congressional war resolution that was passed in October, because, as Mara mentioned, it does not is not consistent with Article 7 of the Constitution, is not legally not a legally sound basis for the president to be taking the country into war. Unfortunately, I think that that the Patriots for Peace that you mentioned in your intro do not include the leaders of the Democratic Party. And I think that we've seen the public line coming from the Democratic leadership is really quite remarkable, given the depth of the animosity towards this war on the part of President Bush that's felt by the Democratic Party base. We heard Tom Daschle saying today that he's, quote, saddened that the failure of diplomacy was so miserable that we are forced to war. Well, this is echoing the Bush administration's own rhetoric that somehow the United States is being forced into war here, when this is clearly an elective war, as people like General Wesley Clark and Norman Schwarzkopf are saying, but the Democratic Party cannot, apparently. This is a war that Bush is choosing. It's not a war that anyone is forced upon the United States.
1-800-958-9008. Amy, yes, go right ahead.
I wanted to jump in here with Dennis Halliday. It's interesting, the president, George Bush, seems to be repeating a number of incidents in history. One, of course, is attacking Iraq, but another, when his father said, "Read my lips," at the time it was about raising taxes, saying he wouldn't, and he did. Well, here you have President Bush at his news conference saying unequivocally, no matter how the nations voted at the UN Security Council, he would go for this second vote. And yet now you have him backing off his statement tonight. The United Nations Security Council has not lived up to its responsibilities, so we will rise to ours. As a man, Dennis Halliday, who worked at the United Nations for more than three decades, your response to what George Bush and the United States is now doing with the Security Council?
Well, I think the president has got it completely wrong. The fact is, happily, the member states of the Security Council have read the Charter. They've seen Articles 1 and 2. They understand Chapter 7 and Articles 41 and 42. And they've decided that the UN stands for peace, not for war. They, in fact, are strengthening the organization by their stand on principle that the organization is not set up to go to war, but it's set up to maintain peace. And that's, in fact, what the UN is doing. So at the end of this process that Mr. Bush has set in motion and this outrageous violence that he plans on Iraq, I think we'll see a stronger United Nations. As somebody has just said, this, of course, this action is totally in breach of the Charter. To go to war on behalf of the United Nations requires action under Chapter 7, Article 42. We do not have that, happily. And to use Article 51, which is a article for defense, is likewise unacceptable. Iraq presents no threat to the United States. Mr. Bush's suggestion that somehow weapons might come from Iraq into the hands of terrorists and those terrorists might use those weapons against the United States is really nonsense. It's a fiction and part of the Washington propaganda that we've learned to hear on a regular basis. Therefore, this action is completely incompatible with the Charter and international law.
What about the what this will inflict on the people of Iraq, this Operation Shock and Awe? What is your assessment? You've gone to Iraq many times, aside from having worked there.
Yes, I was in Iraq last January on two separate occasions. I met with government officials. I met with Iraqi families, friends of mine. I visited their homes. I saw their children, their grandchildren. And I met with people in the shops and streets that I know from my past living in the country, in Baghdad. And, of course, there's tremendous fear amongst Iraqi people that they're facing the horror of American aggression. And I think we're going to see a catastrophe unfold very soon, given this ridiculous 48 hours that Mr. Bush has now presented to the government in Baghdad. And the consequences, I think, are going to be quite horrific. First of all, we'll see war crimes committed yet again by the United States in taking out the infrastructure, that is, power, water and sewage systems, which is in breach of the Geneva Conventions, which will have immediate impact on the well-being of the Iraqi people by destroying their water systems. And waterborne disease will begin to kill, particularly children, I would think, in 2 or 3 days. This is a crime committed before by the father, and now we have the son undertaking the same plan. In addition to that, he plans, I understand, to use depleted uranium as part of the weapons of war, the missiles and other shells and other devices. This is another breach of international law, which will leave contamination in Iraq, in Iraqi cities, and there are many of those. 70% of Iraqis live in towns and cities. So we're going to contaminate these residential areas for 4.5 billion years, which is the half-life of depleted uranium. And we're going to see the massacre, and it is a massacre. This is a country that is no longer strong, has no military capability as it may have had in the past. It presents no threat to its neighbors. I have not met one Arab in the Middle East in recent months who is threatened or feels threatened by a military presence in Iraq. Therefore, we're going to massacre this country, the military, and of course the civilians, through a nightmare of aerial bombardment of a scale which I think we've never seen in the world before. And Mr. Bush has indicated massive use of weapons, including this monster 21-ton bomb, I believe it is, together with presumably consideration of tactical nuclear weapons, which he and Mr. Blair have spoken of in recent weeks. It's, I think the death rates for Iraqi civilians may be quite horrific, and I think Mr. Blair and Mr. Bush will be very much exposed as criminals under international law as the days unfold before us.
Dennis Halliday speaking to us here in New York.
If I could add one point to that, I think it's important to understand that Iraqi civilians are actually more vulnerable going into this war than they were going into the first Gulf War because of the system of economic sanctions that's been in place since the first Gulf War. Under the current oil for food arrangements, as much as 60% of the Iraqi civilian population is completely dependent for their daily bread, their food, on government rations that are controlled under the oil for food program. And one of the first things that will happen if war, when hostilities do break out, is that program will be cut off. And so particularly if we enter a war in which there are prolonged sieges of urban areas like Baghdad or Basra, people trapped inside those cities with their rations cut off could be in very, very grave danger indeed of all manner of starvation and also greater vulnerability to disease as their immune systems decline. So this is really a cause for great concern that the Iraqi population is particularly vulnerable, much more so than the population of another country would be had it not undergone these 12 years of punitive economic sanctions.
Dennis Halliday.
In addition to that, I think you have to remember there's a psychological consequence of 12 years of sanctions and the bombing of the no-fly zones, which has continued now for years. And the people, the resistance of the Iraqi people to the terror of these bombing, imminent bombing attacks on their cities and towns is something we have to keep in focus. I met some children when I was there recently in January. Some of them in their teens, even today, have great fears and inability to sleep at night because of the memories of the bombing attacks of 1991. We're now going to treat a new generation of Iraqi children to the nightmare of bombing, particularly at night. We are creating a whole society of fear and psychological damage that we will have to live with and work with in the future, hopefully in a better environment. But the damage we're creating today is quite horrific.
Okay. We're going to go to our phone lines now, where we're going to invite Chris from Dallas. Chris, you're on the air. Go right ahead. State your question, please. Chris, are you there? Let's go now to Los Angeles, where Bo is joining us. Bo, did you have a question or a comment for our guest?
Yes, I'll make it as brief as possible. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Can you hear me?
Yes,
all right,
we can.
Well. First of all, I believe it's atrocious that Kofi Annan has pulled out the inspectors. I had tried to proliferate the idea of forming a resolution, inundating the UN with them forming a resolution to flood Iraq with inspectors, backing them up with peacekeepers at dams and other installations, and refusing to pull them out. Obviously, that has not happened. My question is for anyone that is it possible to put pressure upon the Security Council and others around the world have them form a resolution to enforce economic sanctions against the United States for this criminal act?
Who wants to take that one?
Well, I think that's certainly
Mara.
An interesting idea. I mean, certainly what the UN should be doing at this point, if it was actually going to conform to its obligations under its charter, would be to take every action to stop the United States from committing this illegal act of aggression and, in fact, defend the people of Iraq from the coming onslaught from the U.S. military. That would be the appropriate action for the UN. I mean, when they talk about using language of the failure of diplomacy, we all understand that all that Bush really means is the failure of coercion and bullying. But the problem here is that the UN is not taking the next step, and the next step would be to stop the United States.
I had thought that only the UN Security Council actually had the authority to call the inspectors, the weapon inspectors, out.
It's really noteworthy that, in fact, it was the U.S. government that was placing the phone calls to tell the UN inspectors that they should leave. And then that was followed by Kofi Annan and then giving an official order.
So is that a legitimate order that was given, or is there a possibility that they may have to recall that?
Well, I think there's several ways to look at that. I mean, certainly one could just take that as another threat from the United States. They're calling up the UN inspectors and telling them to get out or be killed. I mean, at this point, we're not looking at the United States and the government's conduct and any sense of legitimacy or legal authority. They are bullying. They are threatening. I mean, what we heard from President Bush tonight was essentially a terrorist threat. This is a man that used language of a day of horror, but that's what he's about to inflict on the Iraqi people.
Amy?
Verna, I'd like to put this question to Dennis Halliday, having worked at the UN. Paul de Lespinasse, who is a professor at Adrian College in Michigan, wrote a piece called How Kofi Annan Can Stop the War, and it was featured on the commondreams.org website. And he suggested just what the caller did. He said that UN Secretary General Kofi Annan could actually stop this attack by simply not calling the weapons inspectors out. He said, first, it's unlikely Bush and his advisors would proceed with an attack, which would be a public relations nightmare as long as the inspectors are still in Iraq. Second, the announcement would not undermine the work of the inspectors, but could even increase their clout and that of the Secretary General vis-a-vis Saddam Hussein. As long as they remain, the inspectors would protect Iraq from an American attack, but if not given carte blanche to do their work, they would leave. And third, the announcement would become a precedent for greatly enhanced power to be exercised by the Secretary General of the UN. This person is the closest thing we have to a chief executive for the world, and he's a position which it is natural to consider the welfare of the people of the world as a whole. What would you think if Kofi Annan said, we will not withdraw the inspectors, their work is not done?
Well, I agree with our friend in Los Angeles, Bo. His suggestion is quite right, and I think we're all on the same wavelength here. I also was astonished that the Secretary General made this decision. I suggested through the Institute of Public Accuracy that he should not be allowed to make this decision, that it should be reserved for the five permanent members of the Security Council. and assuming that the Russians, French, and Chinese would prevent the withdrawal of inspectors, because their departure tomorrow, I believe, opens the door for Mr. Bush to go to war and to destroy this country and to kill the people of Iraq. The Secretary General, I think, has not had the courage, sad to say, for many years to deal with the United States and the pressures of Washington. He's become an instrument of Washington policy. And to see him do this is really a tragedy for the United Nations. I agree with Amy that he has authority. He doesn't use it. He doesn't use Article 99, which allows him to address issues. This is a man who's failed to note that after 12 years of sanctions, the United Nations has killed over 1 million Iraqis through that military device. That is, sanctions are, after all, a form of warfare.
That was Dennis Halliday. You're listening to part two of the Pacifica Radio Network's crisis coverage of an assault on the peace, the invasion of Iraq. Let's go now to our phone lines once again, where Chris from Fairfax, Virginia is on the line. Good evening, Chris. Kareem from Falls Church, Virginia is also on the line since Chris isn't there. Kareem, how are you this evening?
Hi. How are you today?
Just fine. Do you have a question for our panelists?
Yes. First of all, I am honored to get on the phone and to tell you that you run a fantastic show, and I listen religiously every evening, 6 p.m.
Thank you.
And my comments are that there is a solution for this terrorism, this term that administration uses. Is the solution lies in Palestinian and Israeli occupied territory. If they give up the occupied territory, which belongs to Palestinians, there will not be any attacks against Israelis or any attacks anywhere else. And they know this. But there's so much Israeli influence in Washington that they can't do anything about it. They have kept Palestinians oppressed. You know, they don't have any rights. They go and bulldozer their homes. They have no basic human rights that people were not given even in this country a couple of years ago.
All right, thank you, Hakeem. Why don't we let our guest respond?
Well, I think you just pointed to one of the central ironies in this entire affair.
Chris Tensing.
The Bush administration's most recent excuse for carrying out this war is that it will, post-war Iraq will be a beacon of freedom of democracy for the rest of the countries in the Arab world to emulate, and that we will have a wave of democratization rolling over the region, leaving Jeffersonian systems in its wake. And, of course, if the peoples of the Arab and broader Islamic worlds could vote to enforce one set of UN resolutions, it would be those resolutions which have called upon Israel numerous times to withdraw its forces from all of the territories occupied in 1967, the Palestinian territories as well as the Golan Heights occupied from Syria. And the United States, of course, traditionally has intervened in favor of Israel in UN discussions and on the Security Council to prevent the will of the international community from being enforced. And so there is a grotesque double standard that is readily apparent to everyone in the Arab and Muslim worlds and is increasingly apparent to not just people in Europe but also to many Americans as well. And so when we have the administration talking at the same in, you know, about enforcing UN resolutions and about democratization and wanting to sow the seeds of democracy in the Middle East, the ironies are truly grotesque.
1-800-958-9008. That's the 800 number to call if you'd like to weigh in on this discussion that we're having. Mara, did you have a comment?
I just wanted to add to what Chris had said that I think it's important to remember that Israel possesses weapons of mass destruction, that Israel is known to have a nuclear program, that there is no effort to remove that from them, that they are committing these atrocities, that they are committing the slaughter and the occupation of Palestine. But it's also important not to mistake the U.S. government's policies and think that they are merely directed by Israeli interests. The U.S. government has its own interests. The Bush administration is certainly driven by its own desires for conquest in the Middle East, recolonization in the Middle East, occupying Iraq because of its massive oil reserves. turning that over to the Bush and Cheney oil buddies and the corporations and the banks and the oil companies that are their true constituency, and that they are able to work hand-in-hand with the Sharon government where they have identical interests or outcomes that serve both of those governments.
Many have said Israel is sort of the white elephant in the living room that nobody wants to talk about with regard to this particular impending war with Iraq. And, of course, we've seen where many a political career has been fallen as a result of speaking to that very issue. Is there yet at the same time who can avoid the Israel factor in this equation?
Well, I think that's true in the United States. I mean, it's really in the United States where, unfortunately, even in the anti-war movement, there are some sectors that would suggest that you cannot address Israel when you're addressing the United States government policy in the Middle East or when you're discussing a war of aggression against Iraq. And it's really not possible to address those issues without acknowledging what Israel is doing to the Palestinians and the relationship of these issues and issues of conquest and occupation. But, you know, around the world, when people are having demonstrations in the street by the millions in Europe and in other areas, they are acknowledging that these issues are related. It's really just in the U.S. where this exists. And it's important to note that criticism of Israel is not anti-Semitism, that the anti-war movement in the United States condemns anti-Semitism, condemns anti-Arab bigotry, condemns all forms of bigotry, and that it is good and proper for people to address the absolutely abhorrent and sick and vicious conduct of the Israeli mm-hmm. government.
Well, I think there's appropriate language to use.
Dennis Halliday.
Go right ahead, Amy. Mm-hmm.
I just wanted Dennis Halliday to comment on this.
Well, just recently I was in Tunisia and in Cairo in Egypt and in Amman and in Turkey, and constantly was reminded that these two issues, the massacre, the terrorism against the Palestinians, and the terrorism of Mr. Bush against the Iraqi people, go hand in hand. They cannot be separated, and the two issues have got to be resolved. And our support of Israel in its genocide against the Palestinians is seen locally to be a much greater threat to the stability of the Middle East than, of course, anything coming or likely to come out of Baghdad. And you're right, I think here in the States we somehow forget these two things are interlinked. But in the Middle East, they are absolutely one large problem that has to be dealt with. And the U.S. is seen to be the critical difficulty in both cases.
We're going to go back to the phones now, where Chris from Fairfax, Virginia, is joining us. Are you there, Chris?
Yeah, I'm here.
Do you have a question for our panel?
Yeah, I've got a question. I'm saying, like, if we live in a democracy where, you know, the government is run by the people and all this for the people, how come we don't impeach Bush? And I know we're trying to, but exactly, I don't know, well, how come we're not, like, doing it? You know, like, what is exactly missing from what we're doing to impeach Bush?
What has to happen for the president to be impeached is one member of Congress must begin by introducing the articles of impeachment. And again, those articles of impeachment are available at www.votetoimpeach.org. They are printable. There are petitions available. There needs to be one member of Congress, though, who has the courage to introduce those articles. And then ultimately, this needs to be referred to the Senate. That's the process. But what we're seeing is that it's really the people of the U.S., as with the anti-war movement, that are taking the leadership. Congress is following. Mm-hmm. It's the people that have to lead.
Have you suggested to any members of Congress, Mara, that they actually be the one to introduce this resolution?
The articles of impeachment have been made available to members of Congress, but there is no member of Congress who has stood up yet and said that they would be willing to introduce them.
Mm. And in fact, we did make that statement to U.S. Representative Sheila Jackson Lee when she was on Peace Watch today, and she said she had not considered it and didn't actually say whether she would consider it or not. Let's go now to Joanne, who is on the line from New York City. Good evening, Joanne. Are you there, Joanne?
Oh, I am. I'm sorry. Yeah, I was turning. Anyway. As far as the public, instead of just having rallies, I think we may have more control than we realize. There may be something that could be started where we can maybe not pay our taxes, to fund the government, or there may be some things that we can do. I don't know. I haven't thought it through. But I think it's something important for us to consider, that all of us who are against the war, there must be something other than just marching and getting nowhere with that to have something come about. I mean, there must be something. I think we're not using our heads. Marching maybe is not the only thing we can do.
I think marching is critical. I want to support
critical.
That last caller because I think what she's saying is really a sentiment that people are feeling throughout the United States. I mean, the marching and the mass mobilization is critically important because, in fact, it has brought hundreds of thousands of people into the streets who've never been politically active before, who are feeling empowered for the first time, who are feeling the weight of their actions, who are engaging in the political process in traditional grassroots democracy. But it is true that there is another element out there that is critical with the government that is going to take this type of action, and that is non-cooperation. The fact is that this administration, Bush and Cheney, they don't fight the wars. They aren't going to send their children to kill or be killed. They are not the ones that load the trains or the trucks, you know, or the ships. And while they can call a war, they can't make it happen. Mm-hmm. And if people around the world don't cooperate, we've seen mass strikes throughout Europe, work stoppages. And as of tonight, there is a call that's going out nationally from a number of the major anti-war coalitions, from the Answer Coalition, from Not in Our Names, from Green Party USA, from NYCLAW, from a coalition of religious organizations. They are calling for no business as usual on Wednesday, the day of the ultimatum.
You're listening to part two of the Pacifica Radio Network's crisis coverage of An Assault on the Peace, the invasion of Iraq. If you're listening to us on one of our sister stations, WPFW in Washington, WBAI in New York, KPFK in Los Angeles, or KPFA in Berkeley, or KPFT in Houston, we invite you to call in. The number is 1-800-958-9008. I'm Verna Avery Brown. My co-host is Amy Goodman. And our guests in the studio are Mara Verheiden-Hilliard, a constitutional rights attorney and co-founder of Partnership for Civil Justice. She's also working with former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark on articles of impeachment for President Bush. Here in our Washington studio as well is Chris Tensing of the Middle East Report, a publication of the Middle East Research Information Institute in Washington, D.C. And Amy, your guest in the studio there in New York, Dennis Halliday.
Here in New York, I'm joined by Dennis Halliday, who was Assistant Secretary General of the United Nations, worked at the UN for more than 30 years. I said earlier he'd been arrested. No, that's one of the actions he has not engaged him. But he did quit as head of the Oil for Food program in Iraq, calling the sanctions program genocidal. And speaking of quitting, today, Tony Blair suffered another major political casualty with the resignation from his cabinet of Robin Cook, the leader of the Commons and a former foreign secretary. Dennis Halliday, what is the significance of this? Claire Short, another high-level British official, also said she will quit.
I think it's very important. I think Mr. Blair is losing control of the Labour Party. The statement today made by Mr. Straw, the foreign secretary, was against a background which said that Mr. Blair will have to call on the Conservatives to carry a motion to continue his ambitions for war together with his brother, Mr. Bush. Quite astonishing situation for Mr. Blair. And it would seem to me that his days are probably numbered and that he will lose office. Right now, in my own country, in Ireland, I've asked for the resignation of the Prime Minister of Ireland. He has allowed U.S. warplanes and troops on their way to Kuwait to land in Ireland, and he's continued that policy, and he will continue that policy, I understand. And now that Mr. Bush is embarking on an illegal war without UN support, this becomes another crime, and I think the Taoiseach, the Irish Prime Minister, should resign. I asked that question today on Irish radio. I think we're going to see a number of casualties. Let's hope that we'll see the same in Washington in the near future.
Let's go now to the West Coast, where Renee is calling in from L.A. Renee, your question or comment, please.
Hi. I had two quick questions. The first is, what is it going to take, or what are some suggestions to get the Democrats to take some leadership and some action for peace? And secondly, I wanted to get the panelists' opinion on how they think North Korea factors into this whole equation of war with Iraq.
Thank you, Renee. Anyone want to take a stab at that? Chris.
I can take the first half of the question. I think that the anti-war movement, one of its notable accomplishments to date is that it actually has induced a few Democrats, including two of the presidential candidates, to run on moderately anti-war positions, not as strong as we would like, of course, but at least moderately so. And this has broken the stranglehold that the Bush administration had on all foreign policy debates after September 11th and has made it permissible for the mainstream media to cover the debate over Iraq with a little bit more objectivity than it had been beforehand. This is not an accomplishment of these individual Democratic politicians. It's an accomplishment of the anti-war movement, which made it essentially safe for politicians to come out and say these things because they felt that there would be some support. And yet, I think it's absolutely a real statement on how debased our democracy is that the alleged opposition party in this town is still basically making it the same cynical bet that it made leading into the midterm elections last November, basically hoping that this war will be over soon and that it will go away as an issue and that they can return to, quote, democratic issues, unquote, like healthcare and the economy. And they're not playing the role of an opposition party, and they're not standing up for what's right in this situation. And it's extremely discouraging. One would hope that the anti-war movement can continue to build on its accomplishments and begin to inject some element of sanity into the national discussion about Iraq.
I think it's very important that people not look to the Democratic Party as salvation. And the fact is there is not a huge difference between the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. And they have shown that repeatedly, including last year when the Democratic Party was the one that was pushing to get the resolution through because they didn't want to have to discuss Iraq during the elections. I mean, this is an enormous failure. And the concept in the United States that we have a democracy is just mistaken at this point. What we have is a plutocracy in the United States. And the second part of that question with regard to North Korea, I mean, all you have to do is look at what the Bush administration has said with their nuclear posture review and, again, with their national security strategy that both came out last year. They have said that Bush says he has the right to wage nuclear war, first strike nuclear war against even non-nuclear nations. All that can do is tell countries all around the world that they should probably get their own nuclear weapons as a deterrent, which just destroys 50 years of non-proliferation efforts and, you know, is causing an enormous threat from this government.
I was particularly struck by his comment regarding I'm searching for that exact quote, something about the fact that, responding only after they have struck first is not self-defense, it's suicide.
And what if other countries begin to apply that back to the United States or other entities?
Martina is on the line from Los Angeles, 1-800-958-9008. If you'd like to join the discussion, Martina, you have a question or comment for our guest this evening.
Hi, thanks a lot for having me be with you. I think what strikes me so much over this past weekend was the fact that these three men had to meet on an island. And it should be, I think, glaringly obvious to all of us that they are incredibly isolated and they could not meet anywhere in Europe or the United States. I think, to me, that's actually quite profound. As I listened to Bush tonight, I kept thinking to myself, is he talking about himself or Hussein? I mean, it was very unclear to me, given the fact that he is going to be committing these atrocious war crimes, as you've all been talking about this evening, and, you know, our refusal to even ratify the International Criminal Court Treaty, I think, is also important. One question I had was that, you know, Nelson Mandela has said that the way the United States has been dealing with the UN and Kofi Annan in particular has been racist. And I was wondering if you all could comment on that and talk a little bit more explicitly about what race has to do with this particular war that we're about to embark on. Thank you.
Dennis Halliday? Or?
For one thing, I wanted to expand the metaphor a little further. As you talk about these three men, the Prime Minister of Spain, Aznar, the Prime Minister of Britain, Blair, and Bush, meeting on an island, we can add to that in a sea of protest around the world. Because even this weekend, following up on a few weekends ago, you had more than 1 million people who marched against war around the world, from the United States to Australia and New Zealand on the other end of the earth. But that issue that Nelson Mandela raised, talking about George Bush and Blair not daring to do this to the UN if the Secretary General wasn't for the first time a black man. Dennis Halliday.
Well, it's a very sensitive issue. I must say I agree with Mandela on just about everything he says. And recently, you may recall, he mentioned the total lack of moral authority of the United States. He reminded us of the atrocities committed by the United States in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. I don't believe he's right when it comes to racism and the Secretary General. I think it's a much bigger issue. I think Washington and the conservative born-again right wing has rejected international law over a long period. This is not a new venture. This is a thinking process that's been ongoing for some time. And the rejection of international law and the rejection of the United Nations, I think, has left us in the plight we are today, where we have the arrogance here in the United States to reject the United Nations, to declare vetoes are not valid when we don't cast them ourselves, and see ourselves in a position to go for a preemptive or a preventive war as though that was our sovereign right, as though might were right. I mean, concepts that hopefully we had forgotten in the 19th century, and now we see them coming up again in 2003. And as Martina said, we've just lost the ICC in terms of the United States, just when obviously we need the protection the ICC would provide to keep the U.S. military and U.S. civilians like Cheney, Bush, and Rumsfeld under some form of control.
Let's go now to Falls Church, Virginia, where Paul is on the line. Good evening, Paul. You have a question.
I had a brief comment, if that's okay.
Yes, that's fine.
I consider myself very patriotic. I love this nation, but I hate what's being done in the name of America. I have a brief comment in the form of an extremely short poem, if that's okay.
How brief?
It's called
Very brief, I
it's
hope.
Called the, yes, very brief.
Okay.
It's called The Dread. I dread allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and duping the public for which it stands, one nation under George, indefensible, with liberty and justice forestalled.
Okay.
That's it.
All right. Thank you, Paul, for sharing that creative expression. He does touch upon an emotion. I think a lot of what we call patriots for peace have had to bear the burden of being called unpatriotic. I like to think that when they say support the troops, support the troops and stop the war. 1-800-958-9008 is the number to call if you'd like to weigh in on our discussion. Hunter in Los Angeles, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you today?
We're just fine, thank you. Do you have a question or comment?
Good. Well, I have a comment. I was listening, and I think that number one, to make a statement that is anti-Israeli and then say it's not anti-Semitic can't really be true. It's a Jewish state. And number two, the land that Israel took in the Six-Day War, they never started that war, and that to the spoils go the victor go the spoils. And I think that it's unfortunate, but they're not using their weapons of mass destruction on their own people, and I don't think that they can be compared to somebody like Iraq or Hussein or any of those people.
Chris, did you want to respond?
Let's put that
well,
comment.
Well, Chris was going to actually respond, Amy.
Go ahead, Chris Tenzing.
Yes.
Thank you. Well, actually, Israel did start that war. That was a preemptive war launched by Israel against all of the countries that it fought. Israel justified its action on the grounds that it was under imminent threat of attack, but careful historians have shown that there was actually some possibility of averting war. In fact, the United States itself was trying to avert war. Lyndon LBJ's administration had called the Egyptian vice president to Washington for urgent consultations on the Egyptian troop buildup when Israel launched its preemptive assault on Egypt. So it's a matter of historical record that that was a preemptive war launched by Israel. And the international community has consistently, in the form of UN resolutions, denounced the occupation of the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, East Jerusalem, and the Golan Heights as illegitimate and are based upon the simple principle that territory acquired through conquest is that is inadmissible in the court of international law. So I don't think that there's much disagreement on that point, except perhaps in the United States. And I do think that it is certainly possible to criticize the policies of the government of Israel without being anti-Semitic. Of course, to appreciate that point, one only has to realize that the spectrum of debate among the Jewish citizens of Israel about the policies of the Israeli state is much more free-ranging and open than our debate here in the United States. It's possible to criticize the Israeli government. It's possible for Israeli citizens to criticize the Israeli government in ways that one is slapped with all sorts of names for doing so in the United States. So I really think that's a false comment to make, that it's not possible to criticize the government of Israel without being anti-Jewish.
1-800-958-9008. Let's go now to Pasadena, where Brenda is on the line. Good evening, Brenda.
Good evening. I want to thank Pacifica because I feel that you are our last bastion of real journalism and real news. I applaud and commend everyone there.
Thank you very
much.
Allowing
us this opportunity to speak our opinion. I am speaking out in reference of everyone alerting themselves to the importance of knowing of what the Patriot Act 2 is going to do to our civil liberties. I believe that the Bush junta is actually the Fourth Reich. There are too many ties to Hitler and Nazi Germany with his grandfather, Prescott Bush, for us to not look at the fact that aside from a regime change, we need a revolution. This should never have been allowed to happen. And 9/11 definitely allowed an opportunity for there to advance their new world order. And it's not a conspiracy theory anymore. It's in our face, and I believe that his speech this evening was not only a warning to Iraq, but a warning to the citizens of this country. And I'm a patriot. I love this country. But I also believe that peace is the highest sense of patriotism. And you can take me off the air. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Brenda. And I want to invite all of our listeners to visit our website, www.pacifica.org, if you'd like to support this type of programming. Let's go now to James in Los Angeles. James, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hello.
What I'm beckoning back to is about a year ago or so, I read the speech to the cadets in the New York Times where GW is ordering preemptive strikes on anybody that we may even suspect could be a threat of us. You know, and on that day I wrote a letter to each of my senators. You know, actually I sent it out to all 50 of them, and I asked, what is up with this? You know, part of my question or part of my point is, like, in the last year and a half, what has happened? And also my next question would be, is at one point, when does this become violent on the United States of America, and when at one point do the citizens become violent? That's a fear I have, you know, because how long, you know, that people, the comparisons will be drawn, and I don't mean to be an alarmist, but, you know, something's been banging around the back of all of our heads is, you know, isn't this what they said about Nazi Germany?
Well,
do you understand my point?
Yes.
The Bush administration issued its national security strategy of September 20th, 2002, in which they laid out essentially their view of their right to have global domination, to support their economic program, to enforce that worldwide. And it was actually just an echo of a similar report that had been written by many of the same people 10 years earlier, which when that had come to light, they backed off from it. But now they feel with great arrogance and security that they can push that forward as the policy of the United States. And what we're seeing in the United States with the Patriot Act, like the prior caller had referenced, is really the domestic component of an adventurous foreign policy of conquest. It is an effort to set up mechanisms for repression in the United States, because ultimately, both worldwide and in the U.S., there will be resistance, as there always is, to this kind of oppressive activity.
You know, I also want to add on the issue of democracy. There was an interesting piece in the Los Angeles Times about a classified State Department report expressing doubt that installing a new regime in Iraq will foster the spread of democracy in the Middle East, a claim Bush has made in trying to build support for war. The report exposes significant divisions within the Bush administration over the so-called democratic domino theory, one of the arguments that underpins the case for invading Iraq. The report, which has been distributed to a small group of top government officials but not publicly disclosed, the LA Times writes, says that daunting economic and social problems are likely to undermine basic stability in the region for years, let alone prospects for democratic reform, and that even if some form of democracy took root, an event the report casts as unlikely, anti-American sentiment is so pervasive that elections in the short term could lead to the rise of Islamic-controlled governments hostile to the United States. Again, this report in the LA Times about a classified State Department report that casts doubt on any ability to spread democracy, if that's the reason that Bush is putting forward. Dennis Halliday, I'd like you to comment on that. And the idea that intelligence over and over again in the United States we are seeing really cutting against the reasons that George Bush is putting forward, like, for example, George Tenet going to the Senate and saying that a new nuclear arms race has been launched among small nations, very much looking like it's a response to Rumsfeld saying the U.S. could engage in a preemptive nuclear attack. So people, countries, want to arm themselves. Intelligence seems to undermine what George Bush is saying.
Well, you know, what's interesting, here we are obsessed with our democracy here in the United States. I mean, we seem to now have a one-party system, although in theory I know there are two. Maybe we should try a multi-party system, which might be more interesting and give us coalitions that might, in fact, reflect better the views and the willing of the American people. In the Middle East at the moment, I think people do not see the United States representing a democracy anymore, or certainly not a democracy that they want any part of. I think they see U.S. policy and they consider it with contempt. They have a certain sense of pity towards Americans who clearly are not well represented in Washington and do not support the positions of their president. I think we've seen, interestingly, in Turkey that those in Washington who find democracy problematic overseas must now feel justified, because clearly the Turkish democracy and the decision of the parliament not to accept a $26 billion bribe and allow U.S. troops in Turkey is a very clear indication that Turkey and democracy seem to be growing very nicely together, and I hope they get into the EU as soon as possible. You know, in the management business, when you want to make change, you normally talk to your friends or your supporters or those who sympathize with your position first. Strangely, in the Middle East, the United States doesn't talk to Kuwait or Saudi Arabia or the Gulf states, doesn't consider asking them, it seems, to go a democratic route, to have constitutional change, to go for a multi-party system. No. They seem to go to Iraq, where democracy seems to be an imposition, almost a form of punishment. And when imposed by a military regime from outside, is just, in my view, condemned to failure. And I've never met an Iraqi who welcomes this invasion or this occupation and is prepared to see American democracy grow in Iraq.
If I can make two quick additions to that, I think the most telling action of the United States with regard to democracy in the Middle East and the alleged loyalty of the United States to the outbreak of democracy in the Middle East, after the Turkish parliamentary vote a couple of weeks ago, the U.S. ships, troop ships, rather than leaving, decamping immediately for the Suez Canal to go and deploy in the Persian Gulf, actually sat patiently offshore, fully expecting this parliamentary, democratic parliamentary verdict to be reversed. And in fact, today we see the leader of the Turkish AKP, the ruling party, scheduling an emergency vote to reconsider Turkey's position. And so it's clear that the United States wants the kind of democracies that rubber stamp its own policies in the region. The other point is that even the U.S.-supported Iraqi opposition forces, the feckless so-called umbrella group, the Iraqi National Congress, which has falsely claimed to represent Iraqis inside and outside the country for many years with the encouragement of the neoconservatives in Washington. Even that group and its allies in the Iraqi opposition to Saddam Hussein have said repeatedly that they oppose a U.S. occupation of post-Saddam Iraq. So this sentiment is widespread. The sentiment that Dennis Halliday was referring to is widespread even among those Iraqis who have been bankrolled by the United States for the last 10 years.
Mm. Thank you. We have a few more callers who'd like to get in on our discussion before we have to close out the program this evening. Let's go to Hunting Beach, California, where Patrick is on the line. Good evening, Patrick. Your question or comment, please.
Good evening. I'd like to hear comments from your commentators on the what seemed to me to be the brutal, cold-blooded murder of Rachel Corrie in the Gaza Strip over the weekend. The picture that I saw in the Los Angeles Times of her facing the bulldozer seemed to me pretty clearly that the bulldozer operator knew she was there.
Anyone?
And, the pictures are really frightening. And I encourage people to go to democracynow.org. We did 1 hour of our expanded two-hour show today on Rachel, playing excerpts of interviews she had done and also being joined by one of her colleagues in Gaza. She's with an international solidarity movement who watched the bulldozer run over Rachel as she stood there with a bullhorn in a fluorescent orange jacket. As they pleaded with the bulldozer to back off, they ran over her and then ran back over her. And I'm wondering, when we see George Bush also urging all foreign nationals, including journalists and inspectors, to leave Iraq immediately, mm-hmm. if a very powerful message wasn't sent, both in Gaza on Sunday and in George Bush's statement tonight. They don't want internationals or foreign observers to witness what is going on there. And a young American woman, a kind of ambassador from the United States, was a great danger as the Israeli military mm-hmm. seals Gaza and right. the West Bank. And the same thing we're seeing right now with Iraq.
Okay. We're going to get final comments now from our guests in the studio as we wind down this special broadcast of Pacifica Radio, An Assault on the Peace, the Invasion of Iraq. In our studio, so final comments from Mara. Do you want to make your...
I want to urge everyone. I think that people are feeling, you know, they have for months, that the administration has tried to suggest inevitability and absoluteness to their course of conduct, but that is not the case. The people have the ability to resist, and this anti-war movement has grown to a social justice movement. I would urge everyone to go and participate in Wednesday's No Business as Usual actions and to go get information at internationalanswer.org.
Okay.
And to pick up on that point, it's also very important for the anti-war movement not to, in addition to saying stop the war if the war does in fact break out, it also needs to transform itself into an anti-occupation movement to resist what very likely will be a U.S. military occupation of Iraq.
Dennis Halliday, final comments quickly, please.
Well, Mr. Bush tonight told us that here in the United States we are a peaceful people. He must be excluding himself and the regime around him in Washington. But it's a signal, I think, to Americans that mm-hmm. they are the last hope. They must stand up and be counted and stop Mr. Bush taking us all into this terrible war.
Okay. Thanks to our producers, Scott Gurian, Lona Elias, and Reem Kadhuda. I'm Verna Avery Brown. My co-host, Amy Goodman.
And thank you very much to Mike Burr, yes, producing in New York.
Our engineer here in Washington was Granger Helvey. We had production assistance from Jim Bennett at KPFA and Ron Pinchback at WPFW. Special thanks to our guests tonight here in our studios in D.C. We had Chris Tensing, editor of the Middle East Report, as well as Mara Verheiden-Hilliard of the Partnership for Civil Justice on the steering committee of the activist group Answer Act Now to Stop War and End Racism. In New York, we had Dennis Halliday, former humanitarian coordinator in Iraq, as well as my co-host, Amy Goodman. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Thank you all for listening.